Blog Talk Radio.
Howdy, welcome to Homemade Business 101. My name is Isaiah. I have the pleasure of introducing the host. You know him, he's everybody's hero, my best friend. Will you please join me in welcoming my granddaddy, Baba Jahi?
Well, good morning to you, listening audience out there. Hey, we thank you so kindly for tuning in and getting up to spend this Sunday morning with us. And for those of you that are catching this later on in the archive, we thank you so much for taking time to once again stop by Home Based Business 101. We'd like to thank the 24,626 people who have tuned in to a show here on Home Based Business 101. This truly is listener supported radio, and we want to thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the various topics and themes that we discuss here on these airways. Hey, well, you know, last Sunday I wasn't on, and that was Sunday, December the 12th, and I don't know, for some reason last Sunday I just wasn't feeling it in terms of doing a show last Sunday, and I don't know, you know, I'm a very spiritual person also, and sometimes, you know, I didn't dwell on it that much until after I got the news, and the news was that, as you know, on Sunday, December the 5th, we did a show with George Sabir, who's been a frequent guest on here, and who was not only a guest, but a friend and a comrade and a brother. And, you know, we shared a lot, you know, and he shared a lot here on these airways last December the 5th. He talked about Kwanzaa, the fourth principle, Ujamaa, and how can we make it a reality. And then last Sunday, December the 12th, I didn't feel like doing a show. I didn't do a show last Sunday. And George had a massive heart attack and transitioned. And we, you know, in the African context, we say transition. He's transitioned on to become an ancestor. And with that, I'm going to read Oath to the Ancestors as I start this show off today as a tribute to my friend, my brother, and my comrade, George Sabir. Oath to the Ancestors. O ancestors, blacker than a thousand midnights, African ancestors, it is to you that we, your children, give respect and honor. O ancestors, we call upon you and welcome you in this place. African ancestors, let your presence fill this place. O ancestors who have been purposely excluded from the history books so that the world would not know of your greatness. Our African ancestors who gave civilization to the world. Our African ancestors who gave the arts to the world. Our African ancestors who gave music to the world. Our African ancestors who gave science to the world. Our African ancestors who gave medicine to the world. Our African ancestors who gave literature to the world. All African ancestors who gave philosophy to the world. Our African ancestors who gave God consciousness to the world. Oh, ancestors, we thank you for devoting your life to make a future for us, your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Now stand with us, strengthen us, guide us, teach us, and protect us from the snare of our enemies. Rise up, O African ancestors, and let our enemies be scattered, and give us the wisdom and the boldness to deal with our oppressors and those who would hinder the liberation and empowerment of our people. Rise up, O African ancestors, and live in us, and we will not fail to honor you. We will not fail to respect you. We will not fail to hear you. We will not betray you. Ashe, 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 ashe. And that is our African ancestors, Oath to the Ancestors, written by Chief Elder of the African Village, the one and mighty Dr. Ray Higgins. So we want to thank Ray for putting that together, and that's, you know, our tribute this morning as George has become an ancestor. And I'm going to read what they wrote about George in the Philadelphia Daily News. George Tower Sabir, author and lecturer. For a man who spent his life in the often frustrating struggle to win justice for African Americans, George Russell Tower Sabir embodied the meaning of the Swahili word that he added to his given name. Sabir means patience in Swahili, and that was one of the main characteristics of George's character. He had incredible patience with people, his brother in Fawasi, Lintower, said. Even people who did unjust things to him, he would forgive them. He would try to rationalize why they did it. Me, I'd be throwing things against the wall. George Russell Tower Sabir, who grew up in Philadelphia's George Tower and wrote numerous books of self-advice for African-Americans as George Sabir, he collapsed and died of a heart attack Sunday, December the 12th, while jogging on the track at Penwood High School in East Lansdowne. He was 66 and lived in East Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. He was a major influence on the subject of black entrepreneurship through his writings and speeches. His book, Black Folks' Guide to Making Money in America, published in 1980, was the first to tell blacks that what was missing from their drive for equality and success in the economic arena. This book set off a ton of other authors writing about the topic, his brother said. It was the first book to really address the issue. In 1988, George published what is considered the only sales training book for African Americans, Getting Blacks to Sell. Other books were Black Folks' Guide to Business Success and Money Issues in Black Male-Female Relationships. George traveled the country expounding these views and was in demand in schools and conferences as a speaker and teacher of economic values and business development for blacks. He gained wide recognition for his ideas and was interviewed on the Phil Donahue Show, the Today Show, Tony Brown's Journal, the 700 Club, and was written up in Essence, Ebony, Jet, and Black Enterprise, among others. Always active in developing programs to benefit blacks, especially young people, George was working on a mentoring program for black youth and former prisoners when he transitioned. His aim was to stop what he saw as the revolving door of incarceration for African-American men. George was born in Philadelphia to George R. Tower Sr. and Roxanne Tower. He began running track at Shoemaker Junior High School, and as a member of the mile relay team, participated in the Penn Relays. He continued to run track at Overbrook High School, from which he graduated. After high school, he moved to California and attended Bartlow Junior College and Pasadena City College. He earned a bachelor's degree in history from California State University, Los Angeles, as some of you know, UCLA. He later received two graduate degrees from Rutgers Graduate School of Education and attended Rutgers Law School for a year. In California, in the Black Power 60s, George became involved in the US organization, a black cultural nationalist group founded by Dr. Marlana Karinga, who also started the Observance of Kwanzaa. George returned east and wound up in Newark, New Jersey, where he became associated with the poet and activist Amiri Baraka, the former Leroy Jones. They worked in a successful mayoralty campaign of Ken Gibson, who in 1970 became the first African-American mayor of any major city in the northeastern United States. In 1970s, George was an instructor in black studies at Seton Hall University in South Orange, New Jersey. In 1992, he spoke at the third annual Burlington County Black Business Exposition in New Jersey, where he said he wanted to sell our people on selling. We came here as laborers, and some of us still have the mentality that that's all we can do or supposed to do, he said. Our idea of how to make a living is that you sweat for whites and it's get a product. Let me repeat this part. Our idea of how to make a living is that you sweat for whites, it's get a product and you sell. In 1997, he became the founding member of the Mata Network, an African-American company that distributes black manufactured products nationwide through a network marketing process. And in 1992, he was selected as the East Coast Expansion Coordinator for Compro Tax, an African-American-owned income tax preparation company. He opened 20 tax offices in 7 states. He was the ultimate people person, said M. Fawashi Lintower, former contract administrator of Philadelphia Housing Authority. He had tremendous persistence and drive. It was very hard to discourage him. No matter what failures he encountered, he never let them hold him back. He handled adversity by saying, well, I'll have to try something else. Lynn said that his brother never lost his passion for physical training. He was involved in weightlifting and running, which is why he was on the school track on Sunday. Besides his brother, George is survived by two sons, Ivan Tower and Didisi Tower. And we're going to truly miss Brother George here in the flesh, but we will still have him in the spirit. And then in the spirit, we're going to talk about some of his ideas today and some of the things that really, you know, mattered a lot to him and, you know, mattered a lot also to me. I first came across Brother Sabir in 1988. In 1988, I was involved in a company called A.L. Williams. And being involved in A.L. Williams, I was looking for ways to better be able to market the products that we were marketing, which was term life insurance and mutual funds and an opportunity, you know, building a business opportunity. And I ran across George through his book, Getting Black Folks to Sell. I had already had his book, Black Folks' Guide to Making Big Money in America. And, you know, when I looked at this book, I was like, wow, you know, Brother George is on top of it again. And what intrigued me the most about George was that we had similar paths. We both were people who were involved in the Black Culture Nationalist Movement. I came involved with Dr. Karinga's organization in 1971, when George was there in the beginning in 65. And then I moved, when I left the West Coast and came back home to the Baltimore, Maryland area, I got involved again, similar path with Amiri Baraka and the Congress of African People. And one of the things I said that intrigued me about George was that my same path in development was that I was searching for a way with this Black Culture Nationalist philosophy that Dr. Karinga had put together with the seven principles in Nguzo Saba as we get ready for Kwanzaa. And, you know, this is part one of the Wisdom of George Sabir. I'll be doing another show next Sunday, the first day of Kwanzaa, part two. But, you know, with Kwanzaa, there's seven principles, and for those of you that don't know them, I'll share those principles with you real quick. And one of the ones that we did a highlight on last week is one that always intrigued me the most out of the seven principles. Well, the first is Umoja, unity, to strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, nation, and race. Second, Kuji Chagalia, to define ourselves, name ourselves, speak for ourselves, create for ourselves, instead of being defined, named, and spoken for by others. Third principle, Jima, collective work and responsibility, to build and maintain our communities together and to make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together. The fourth principle, Ujamaa, cooperative economics, to build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses and to profit from them together. The fifth principle, Nia, purpose, to make us our collective vocation to building and developing of our people in order to restore them to their traditional greatness. Kaumba, creativity, to do always as much as we can in a way that we can to leave our communities more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited. Any mighty faith, to believe with all our hearts in our parents, our teachers, our leaders, in the righteousness and victory of our struggle. And, you know, those principles, they mean a lot to me. You know, they're my guiding light. And one of the problems is me and Brother George talked about December the 5th, last show that I did here on my Sunday morning show. We talked about that fourth principle, Ujamaa, and what was holding us back from making cooperative economics a reality. And so, see, this is what, again, it first attracted me to George, because I had similar thoughts that he had, and that was that, you know, network marketing and business, you know, that's something that we needed to look at. How can we talk about enhancing our communities, building our communities, when all of the dollars in our communities was going to other people? And so that began to get me on this path of business development, and to see that George, again, was, you know, was ahead of me. He was, you know, like I said, you know, he had me by a few years. I turned 58 yesterday, and hey, those that gave me birthday wishes, I want to thank all of you for your birthday wishes. For those of you that sent me birthday wishes on Facebook, hey, I really appreciate it. And a couple of my students, former students, sent me birthday wishes with some very, very special messages. And share some of those before I go off today. But as I said, George was 66. You know, I just turned 58. So he got involved in the movement before me. And at the same time began to chart ways in this economic development piece. And that, like I say, intrigued me, and I was looking for a way to take and make my community development work better, you know, for lack of another kind of word I'm searching for there. And, you know, I knew we needed to deal with economics. And, you know, and George, to me, was right on point. His books are still right on point. And, you know, we're going to share some wisdom out of his books this morning. We're going to do, though, here, we're going to take a short station break. You're listening to Home-Based Business 101 here on Blog Talk Radio. This is listener-supported radio. And we're doing a tribute today to our friend, our brother, our comrade, Brother George Sabir, who was way ahead of his time and at the same time trying to help us all get caught up in this whole thing of economic development. So, you know, that's what we're doing today. And I'm going to play a little bit of a song as a tribute to George today. I will be sharing music also throughout the course of this broadcast today. And this one goes out to, again, to George. It's a piece by Gil Scott and Brian Jackson called It's Your World.
The ground beneath my feet, I know was made for me. There is no any one place where I belong. My spirit is to be free, and so now everyone will see. Life was made for us to be what we want to be.
Your World by Gil Scott and Brian Jackson. And yes, George definitely, you know, hey, black economic development definitely was his world. And, you know, as Gil said, you know, when you're in your world, you don't have to belong. You are truly free. And you are truly, truly free. Let's look at some of the things that George talked about. One of the things he talked about, you know, is, again, that he stressed a big point on, is that we came here as laborers. So if you're looking for a job, people, they, you know, and I'm speaking to my audience, the whole audience, but I'm also speaking to my people, African Americans in particular. If you're looking for a job, remember, that's what they brought us here to do, to pick cotton and other stuff. They have a job for you if that's what you want. George said, you know, that we need to look at this business development piece so that we can create meaningful work for our own people. And another way to deal with economics. Remember, they brought us here to do the dirty work, to build their world, as Gil Scott says. You know, we got to build our world. It's our world. How do we build our world? You know, and again, this is, you know, some people don't like to talk about a piece that Taj Mahal put out there. Do you remember the days of slavery? Some of us survived. Barely stayed alive. Hey, we didn't make a choice to come here. We were brought here by force. And some people say, well, y'all need to get over that. No, no, no. It ain't no we need to get over that. You know, and nothing against the immigrants. The immigrants made a choice. even though there might have been some coerced in situations, whatever, but they made a choice to get on the boat to come. We didn't have a choice to get on the boat to come. And that's even though we came on different ships, we're all in the same boat now in terms of what's going on in America. And yes, we can collectively come together and do something about that. It's one of the things that George also talked about was interdependency. But when we enter into interdependency, we must enter into it from a position of strength. That's why we need power. We need power so that when we decide we want to do something, we do it. Now, I'm going to tell you a little hidden secret. You know, for some people, it's not a secret. When Jews get involved in certain companies, and again, I'm not picking on Jews, so the Jewish people don't feel I'm picking on you or anything like that. But I noticed that when y'all get involved in different companies, you make sure that they have a kosher line of products, especially if it's a company dealing with health, nutrition, and stuff like that. Hey, you make sure, you tell them you're not selling it if it ain't kosher. And I respect you for that, and I applaud you for that. Well, you know, as African Americans, we need to make sure when we get involved in stuff that if it ain't kosher to our culture, that, you know, we let people know, hey, you want us to be a part, then you need to accommodate us. See? And, you know, the thing is, again, other people can make those demands and nobody says anything. Why they have power? Because they say that if you don't, then we're going to boycott you. Or we won't help you. You know, we'll shut you down. You know, but when and where do we get that kosher deal? You know, when we make people recognize and respect our culture. See, because until people do that, then we always would be marginalized and we always would be looked at, as Malcolm said, a second-class citizen. Malcolm said you don't have second-class citizens. You got free people and slaves. And so we still got some of us walking around here in slavery today. So I just wanted to get that point in. You know, what I want to do is I want to share a little bit out of George's book, Getting Black Folks to Sell. You know, Getting Black Folks to Sell, because this was the book that really, you know, captured me and said that, you know, hey, I this brother's on point. Because at the time, you know, I knew that getting out here and finding a product to sell was a way to make money. But the problem was, George said, there was no books written by black people for black people on the art of selling. And so, you know, he talks about in his book here, he says, you know, in doing his research for this book, dozens of books and articles were consulted. But in all honesty, he said, I think two of the books were much more enlightening than all of the rest put together. If you are serious about learning to sell, read Secrets of Closing the Sale by Zig Ziglar and Unlimited Power by Tony Robbins. Both books are available in paperback in major bookstores. And so, you know, he was studying this whole sales piece. And then what he did was, you know, from reading other people's material, he came up with a book for us called Getting Black Folks to Sell. He says, the book you hold in your hands right now is probably the only significant attempt in this country to discuss in some detail the art of selling within the context of the African-American experience. I'm sorry. If this is so, then it could very well be that this book is the first of its kind in America, period. Usually a person is very proud of being the first in any venture. I wish I could feel such pride, but I do not. I really feel this topic should have been addressed long before now. What I have done in this book is not reveal a discovery or breakthrough, but simply report plain facts that are truly observant, that any truly observant African American could have done just as easily. Because the ideas discussed in this book are so obvious and so significant in black folks' survival in America, it scares me that no one has seemed to report them. As a people, we face specific dangers and opportunities. We must learn to respond to each of them in a proper way. This, in my opinion, is what leaders are supposed to do, and it frustrates me when I don't see it being done. I feel a sense of shame that so many people in our community carry the title, officially or unofficially, of leader, when in fact they don't know any more about what's going on than the next person. This is both shameful and scary. The black media is particularly partly to the blame. Out of all of the different media outlets, they insist on giving us details of the accounts about 100 people, about 100 different people. We are notified weekly of the ways of actors, actresses, athletes, and singers, diets and exercise, the way they treat their spouse and children, and generally play out their privileged roles as if this information will save black America. If the lack of information sharing is so prevalent among the leadership class, is there any wonder why the masses of our people are so confused? Can you see why they are turned off and tuned out? This is very, very important what George is saying right here. He's talking about that, you know, we get information primarily about those people that are athletes, and I don't have nothing against the athletes. I don't have nothing against the movie stars and the people that got a chance to live a privileged life. But even them, the money that they make, it goes right back to the other people. I never forget when Larry Johnson came out of UNLV, you know, because, you know, I'm a basketball follower, you know. Larry Johnson came out of UNLV, and when he came out of UNLV and he signed his contract, he made his biggest donation to the Jewish Defense Fund. Now, I'm not picking on Jews, and I don't have nothing against Jews, but here's this man, he graduates, and of all of the causes in our community, he couldn't find one to give his money to. So, I mean, this is significant. And one of my mentors, Father A.J. McKnight, who's now in Haiti because he became so frustrated in America, so said he built over 50-some cooperative co-ops in America, and people sabotaged them. Not people from the outside, people from the inside. With a slave mentality, they sabotaged the co-ops and then turned them into private enterprise things when they was designed to benefit the community. And so Father McKnight, he's over in Haiti. He left America. He said, hey, he, I'm not going to go as far as Father has gone, but Father said he thinks it's hopeless for black people in America. He said, because we've been so culturally conditioned to love white people and hate ourselves that we don't do what's in our best interest. So culturally conditioned to hate ourselves and love somebody else. And with Larry Johnson, when he came out of UNLV and he gave all his money that he going to give, a big old donation to another group of people, and you got, you know, black children and black organizations. I mean, he could have gave to Sister Marion Elderman, you know, with the Children's Defense Fund, which is, you know, doing tremendous work. I mean, tremendous work. I could rattle off about 100 different African-American charities that the athletes can donate money to. Some of them are starting to come around now. But again, usually their money goes right back to the people that gave it to them because their concept of black economic development is pitiful, shameful, disgraceful. Yes, we need to learn how to do, again, like in other communities, what's called the dollar multiplying effect, how that we pass money around in our community. I buy something from you, you buy something from another African-American, that African-American buys something from another African-American, and, you know, what that means is this, people. That dollar should change hands 10 times before it leaves our community. And our community comes in, we get paid on Friday, and the people got all of the money back on Monday, again, because we don't look at this economic development piece. And, you know, George was really on top of this in terms of why we need to build our own economic system. George was one of the founding members of MATA, had the largest MATA distribution network, over 1,700 people. He shared with me some of the reasons that endeavor didn't reach its peak or its pinnacle. You know, I'm not going to go over that over here on these airways, but people that know me, if you ever want to engage me in a private discussion around that, I'll talk about it. Some things I'm not going to air on these airways because it's sensitive information. But he had the largest distribution network in my time. George was always looking for a way. He says in his book, Getting Black Folks to Sell, A Time to Reprogram. So this book is a tool to try to change your way of thinking. If you feel very secure and comfortable, maybe you shouldn't. And if you feel lost, hopeless, out of control of your life, maybe you don't have to feel that way either. In this volume, I will talk about selling and survival because more and more of our people will make it based on their decision to sell or not. This volume is also about selling and prosperity because the two concepts are intimately linked. So whether you're looking for just a way to get by or keep your head above water or whether you're looking for financial independence, this book will interest you. Again, this is very important premises that George is talking about. And, you know, we need books like this to help guide us where we're looking at, you know, how to get involved in selling. I mean, too often our young people, they out there selling the wrong commodities, out there selling crack. And, you know, again, why? Because people make it readily available. Those people that want to see the demise of our community make it readily available for our young people to be able to become crack cocaine distributors. It's another form of selling. I mean, you know, if you ain't got no values, that's the hottest commodity in the black community to sell crack, because the people, all the young people always used to tell me, Baba Jahi, I don't sell drugs. Drugs sell themselves. He said, I don't make nobody take it. He said, I don't walk up to somebody and say, you need to buy this crack. He said, they know I got it, and they come looking for me, and they want to get it. Why? Because it's an addiction, and, you know, it's all kind of stuff going on with that. But, I mean, but just check that out. I mean, you know, even, you know, look at Jay-Z and 50 Cent. How did they get started doing what? Selling drugs. See, so our young people, they have this illusion that, you know, hey, I can be like Jay-Z, you know, or 50. You know, I can start off selling drugs and then switch and change the game. Well, it don't work like that for them. I mean, they were fortunate few that got through the system. And, you know, I don't know who they had working with them or whatever, or how they did, however they did, whatever they did. But you got young people who think that that's the way to get started. You know, it's almost like this. I say that rap, basketball, and drugs is a mixed drink. Like a cocktail, you know, the three of them go together. You know, you go to a basketball court and watch people outside playing basketball or the basketball court, I'm willing to bet you any city in America you go to where you got a group of people, group of African-American males hanging around playing basketball all day, you got a drug dealer or somewhere around there. And I'm going to use the word, not drug dealer, because, you know, we don't make the stuff. You got someone that's selling commodities that are illegal, and then you got somebody to think they can rap. The three of those things mixed together, and our community has been very, very deadly and destructive. You know, the NBA came out a couple of years ago, and I remember Allen Iverson, he got mad with, you know, with the NBA, and he corrected them, because Allen was right. When they started saying that the players had to start wearing, you know, respectable clothing, like shirt and ties and stuff. And Allen Iverson said the mafia wear shirt and ties. That make them respectable. So, you know, because they was talking about the players, you know, bling bling with the chains on and throwback jerseys and other stuff, and that they look like drug dealers in a suit and tie, a shirt and tie. And, you know, Allen Iverson said, well, the mafia, they dress up in shirt and ties, and they out here killing people. I ain't killing nobody. See? So we need to. And, you know, this thing is really, really crazy. And the thing is that we need to be able to focus on how do we take our money and build our community. So, again, getting back to George talked about the need to learn how to sell. The need to learn how to sell, but then not only sell, but how do we sell from a black perspective? Now, some people, you say, well, selling is just selling. There aren't no certain kind of perspectives in selling. Well, see, you have to understand in our community is that in our community that we usually have had bad relationships with salespeople. You know, I'm going to give you an example. And, again, I ain't going to call out the ethnic group because I don't want people to think I'm picking on one certain ethnic group this morning. I remember growing up, there was a little store around the corner from me. And one time I went in there, and bought some hot dogs. The hot dogs were green because they had molded. The lady that owned the store told me there was nothing wrong with the hot dogs, that was food coloring. So, you know, I'm a little child. I don't know no better. You know, I take them home. My mother had to go around there, straighten the lady out, and say, I dare you to be selling molded hot dogs and telling my child it's food coloring. See, so we've had some bad relationships with salespeople. So for a lot of our people, sales turns them off. You know, and so that's why we need to understand sales from our own perspective. And that's what George was doing in his book, Getting Black Folks to Sell. We've had, you know, I remember one of the reasons I got involved in A.L. Williams was in terms of selling life insurance. There was a particular type of life insurance that was sold in the black community. It wasn't worth, Art Williams, he called it trash value, but they had something even worse than that. And, you know, I don't use a certain word on these airways, but it was a word that began with an N. So those of you know, you had an N-word, and they called it N-insurance. Why? Because this was sold to us. Now, the name, though, they call it is industrial insurance. I went in some people's house. They had 23 policies. $1,000 here, $500 here, $2,000 there, $600 there. They had been ripped off. And they were paying more premium for all of those policies combined, in which they could have had $250,000 to $300,000 worth of life insurance for less money than maybe the $6,000 worth of life insurance they had totally add up in all of those different policies. Why? Because there was people that took advantage of our ignorance in terms of sales. So, again, George's book, Getting Black Folks to Sell, was very much on point, on time, and one of the things that we definitely need to focus on. And again, like I said, this is part one because I'm no way I'm going to be able to cover everything today that I want to cover in this segment. And, you know, and so I'm going to finish out with a couple other points, and then I got another musical piece that I want to do to tribute to George. He said, the first reason why black people need to learn this new skill called selling is because many of their old skills are no longer useful. Black labor is quickly becoming obsolete. A 364-year tradition of laboring for white folks is coming to a halt, not because they don't like blacks, but because they don't need our labor. You don't believe me? There's a book written by Sidney Wilhelm called Who Needs the Negro? It basically talks about how, you know, as this economy has moved, that because we haven't shifted with the paradigm shifts and that we're just labor, looking for labor-intensive work, there is no more work for us. People got machines, computers, robots to do it faster, better, and cheaper, and all night long. So here we sit as black people with a resume listing 360 years of experience in something that is less and less needed. While this is bad enough, our children are dropping out of school at such a rate or graduating with such poor skills that the national unemployment market sees them as only qualifying for labor-related positions. That means that the least desirable category of workers seems to be the very category that is expanding the fastest in our community. And again, you know, I work with youth, and, you know, the thing is that, yes, our young people need to be taught how to sell. They need to be taught how to sell because, you know, some of the older people, you know, it's going to take a lot to change their outlook. But younger people, if they're going to school and they're being taught how to do something that they're no longer needed for, and the schools are deliberately dumbing them down. I say deliberate, yes, deliberate. You know, and you got every major city, African-American male dropout rate is over 50%. Baltimore is like 70 to 80%. So what happens when you have 70 to 80% of your community 10 years from now with no marketable skills, can't read, can't write? That's the danger in all of this texting. You know, it's cool for sending messages, but some of our youth, all they know how to do is text. Can't write a sentence. Can't not write a sentence. I work with youth. I know what I'm saying. This is not making stuff up. And this brings me to my last point that I want to cover today, and then I'm going to go into more detail next Sunday. Is George was working on a program that we had agreed to collaborate on, and his program was a mentoring program. And the first goal of this program was to open up new categories of income choices and opportunities for each participant, particularly the younger ones in their teens and their 20s. 18, 19, you know, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, how do we open up new income choices and opportunities for them? The second goal is to encourage people who don't want to work for someone else that it's possible for a non-college educated person, even one who may have a criminal record, to make a comfortable livelihood working for themselves. And the third goal was to have a positive effect on the culture of what the particular city he's in, Black Philadelphia. You know, I'm looking at how to do this program in Baltimore, New Orleans, and also where I'm here in Rocky Mount, so that more people of younger generation will focus on owning more businesses, commercial property, and large-scale enterprises. And this is very, very important, this program that George is working on at the time of his transition. And so, you know, I'll be working on how to continue his legacy with this, is because, excuse me, our younger people, they need to know another way, okay? And this is what George was working on, to teach them that it's possible to get involved in sales where they can market products. I mean, even in a company I'm in, not that we go around looking for people with criminal backgrounds, but fortunately, the company and the business that I'm in, if a person made a mistake, it's not held against them. They can actually get involved in the company that I'm in, and they can actually build themselves a network. They can actually rise all the way to the top marketing position that we have, which is that of a national sales director, even though they might have had, you know, a criminal background, might even had a felony. And there's some other network marketing opportunities out there where people can do the same. And one of the things that George was really, really concerned about, he saw network marketing as the transitional program for the African-American community where we can get around those obstacles of this whole labor-intense thing. See, our people are spending money anyway every day on stuff. We're spending money anyway every day on stuff, but who are we spending it with? Who, you know, who are we buying? Who's the person that's marketing the services? We have to position ourselves in every decent, I'm going to use that word because, again, I told you about some of the indecent stuff, in every decent opportunity where a dollar is being transferred, we need to be able to teach our young people how to position themselves in that. So with this program that George has, you know, I'm going to be reaching out to people in other cities who might be interested in partnering with me to carry out this program. Since I have a nonprofit, we'll be doing it under the banner of Movements Unlimited as a tribute to George. I've already had some people that, you know, have gotten back to me. And, you know, part of the process was, you know, to select businesses to participate in from about five or six different enterprises and programs that can at least help a young person earn at least $500 per month or more. And to mentor them and help them become financially literate. I mean, this is a whole thing. People talk about computer literacy. Well, you know, financial literacy is also very important. That's one of the things that Robert Kiyosaki be talking about out there, financial literacy. And so, you know, hey, this gives you a taste of George. Again, like I say, there's so much to cover that, you know, this will probably end up being a four-part segment. We did part one today. And, George, if you're watching over us, hey, my brother, you know, I'm going to miss you. Again, you can go back. For those that want to hear the last interview that we did with George, the show that we did on December the 5th, Ujamaa, we spent a whole 90 minutes together talking that morning on these airwaves. And, you know, some very, very valuable information that George shared on that show. And, hey, go back and check that out. And, again, I want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening to Home-Based Business 101 this morning. I'm going to close out with another little bit of Gil Scott. Haran, do a tribute to George this morning, and something, it goes a little something like this. Get ready to come up here as we wrap up. And the song by Gil Scott that I'm going to play is called It Must Be Something, Must Be Something, Must Be Something We Can Do. We didn't come this far to give up now. Okay, come on, player. You know, when your computer, when you want these things to move fast, here we go. All right, we're going to close out with Gil Scott. and Brian Jackson. Must be something. Hey, Brother George, we miss you, we love you, and we thank you for watching over us this morning as an ancestor.
Thank you.